Welcome to Whiskey Cask, Cask Strength Conversation, featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 315 for May 8th, 2011. Coming up in a few minutes.
And at the time, I kept the last 3 or 4 gallons and I bottled it into 40-ounce bottles, saying I will put that into my old bottles. And I still have the whiskey. And it was tested a number of years ago by one of the guys at Barrows, and he said it was still fine. So I still have it. I must taste a bit myself someday.
That's Michael Hedigan. His family has owned the Brian Boru pub in Dublin for more than 100 years now, on the end of an Irish tradition nearly 40 years ago, back when pubs used to sell whiskey in the wood out of casks straight from the distillery. Lessons in history and business coming up, along with some of the sights to see if you visit Dublin. I'll also have the emails of the week, the calendar of events, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department. You might be able to guess what that'll be focusing on. First off, let's look at the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. The main reason I was in Ireland was for the Irish Distillers' launch on Thursday of 2 new whiskies in its single pot still Irish Whiskies of Middleton range. Irish whiskey sales have been booming worldwide, and in fact, Irish Distillers has another event this week marking Jameson's first year with sales of 3 million cases. In addition to the new pot still whiskies, Irish Distillers also disclosed plans for a massive expansion project at its Middleton distillery near Cork, with a budget of around $140 million to double the distillery's capacity. The first phase will be a new warehouse complex just up the road from Middleton at Dungorney. Middleton has 38 warehouses now and has been adding 2 a year, but there's no more room available at the site. As for those new pot still whiskies, the Powers John's Lane and Middleton Barry Crockett Legacy join the Redbreast 12 and 15-year-olds and Green Spot in the single pot still Irish Whiskies of Middleton line. Brendan Buckley of Irish Distillers told me it's a natural step in more than a century of making pot still Irish whiskey.
In the last, let's say, 10 years, we've just seen this kind of organic growth, and it's hard to pin it down, but we'd like to think that maybe Jameson has had a little role to play in it, because, you know, as our flagship brand, it's been somewhat blazing a trail around the world, introducing a lot of people to the taste of Irish whiskey. Within the heart of Jameson is, of course, is pot still, and then when people come into it, they want to dig a little bit deeper, and if you dig deeper into Jameson, you'll find your way eventually to the heart of it, which is pot still whiskey, and then you discover brands like Redbreast, and if you dig even deeper, you'll find brands like Greenspot. So we were watching this happening, and, you know, curiously, as marketeers, we had nothing to do with it. So it just happened of its own accord. So we said to ourselves, there's something going on here. We need to look into it. And on the back of that, we decided to develop some more, and which led us to today, which is the new range and the addition of 2 new single pot still whiskies to the range. So that's the first part of your question, I think. The second part is that the fact that we have called these whiskies for over 200 years pure pot still. And if one was to walk around the distillery where we are today, you will see old, you know, advertisements and old you know, pictures and old medals from, you know, international whiskey fairs 100 years ago. And they were awarding pure pot still Irish whiskey. And we continue that tradition of selling pure pot still Irish whiskey for many, many, many years. But unfortunately, we've run into some legal difficulties in the last 4 to 5 years, most notably in the United States. And we've had, as a consequence, to change the terminology and introduce a phrase, which I actually think in hindsight is maybe no bad thing, that we're now calling what was once pure pot still Irish whiskey single pot still, because at least it's bringing in a terminology that a lot of whiskey drinkers, you know, most probably single malt drinkers, can understand. So maybe it's an ill wind that's blowing us some good.
Where will these whiskies be available and how soon?
Okay, in the short term, they're available as of tomorrow, pretty much right throughout Europe. We're in the middle of working on a US version, so a 750 ml bottle, and labeling that will satisfy the US regulations. How long that will take, I can't answer, because sometimes the workings, we're not entirely certain of the whys or wherefores, but we are working toward it.
I know that Alex Ricard was saying tonight you have a 22-year plan to bring out more of these single pot stills over time?
Correct. I mean, when we embarked on this, it wasn't just about bringing out two new whiskies today, because, you know, we realized we have a tremendous opportunity, but also a tremendous sort of responsibility to stand up and be counted when it comes to doing the right job on this. So we have, in conjunction with the distillery team here, put together a innovation and release plan, which genuinely, and Alex wasn't, you know, he wasn't spoofing, 22 years out, we have earmarked new releases for the next 22 years, on average, releasing two whiskies per annum for the next 22 years, all uniquely different, all involving the four brands and maybe some new brands on top of that, but all different versions and different you know, angles on them. And, you know, which is brilliant. Like, we have a brand for, like, Green Spot. You heard today, Mark, Green Spot is this really unique, rich tradition of the very spot colors. You don't have to be a genius to figure out we're going to have a look at the old spot colors and trying to recreate those. And indeed, you know, within the Middleton range, some of the ideas we have been experimenting with over the last few years are already bearing incredible fruits. And so I'm personally excited to see some of these coming out. In fact, the challenge is to hold back, because some of them you could potentially release tomorrow, but, you know, we need to take our time and, you know, release them in an orderly fashion.
Now, just so no one confuses these whiskies with single malts, I asked Middleton master distiller Barry Crockett to define the terms.
Irish Pastel Whiskey is the traditional whiskey in Ireland. It's produced initially from a mash of dried barley and malted barley. It's then, in our case, triple distilled in copper pot stills. When we refer to the term single, we're speaking about a pot still whiskey distilled in the one site or from the one distillery. So in effect then, when we speak about Middleton Distillery, because of its complexity and size, we have the ability to distill a number of styles of Irish pot still whiskey, all obviously distilled on the one site, and so therefore we append the term single.
Let's explain the tastes here, because you were able to create, as you say, a number of different tastes, and the two new releases reflect those in that you were trying to at least replicate as closely as possible the taste of the old Powers John's Lane distillery with the Powers John's Lane release, right?
Each of the existing old distilleries produced Irish Pastel whiskey in a unique manner. And what we currently do today, and obviously we are aware of that background, we endeavour to reproduce the flavour profile, the flavour pattern of the John's Lane experience. That, of course, means that we take the appropriate mash bill, as we describe it, and we distill a specific style of whiskey in a manner that we believe best replicates what happened in the John's Lane distillery. Now, I must say that, of course, it's not identical, because in today's terms, we're looking at a modern facility, far better controls, better quality, and so therefore the spirits, the pot still whiskies of today, are more refined than would have been the case, or indeed would have been possible, say 50 or 60 years ago.
I would be remiss if I did not ask you about the other release, the one that carries the Middleton name but also carries your name, the Middleton Barry Crockett Legacy. First of all, tell me what it's like to have your name appear on this bottle. I know during the tastings during the day you were referring to it as the Middleton Legacy out of modesty, but what does it feel like to you to see your name and a picture of you on the bottle?
Well, I must say, Mark, it's some degree of awe, I suppose, really. Certainly, it's a great honor. I feel that it's a mark of respect, and it's a mark also, I'd have to say, of confidence. So in the round, I must say that I'm very, very taken with the fact that I've been so honoured in this respect. It's again, I suppose, a tribute to a lot of the work which not just myself but a lot of other people have been doing in Middleton over many, in fact, you could say decades now at this point in time. But in summary, a sense of honour, that I've been credited with this particular Middleton selection. It's a matter of great pride.
And also for your entire family and your legacy, because your father was master distiller here too, right?
Indeed, he was the master distiller here in the old Middleton Distillery, where we're standing this evening. It's a mark also of the fact that he, in his time, in quite difficult times, endeavoured to be innovative in regard to the distilling practices that then existed. And, of course, the current Middleton obviously takes its name and its provenance from the fact that there was indeed a range of Middleton Postle whiskies from the old distillery. They had to disappear for a period of time, and it's tremendously exciting to see that we now have the Middleton Barry Crockett legacy as a single Postle whiskey from the distillery receiving so much attention again.
You may remember my first visit to Middleton back in episode 279 last September. At the end of that episode, I mentioned that master blender Billy Layton brought out a sample of a prototype whiskey after dinner. Guess what it turned out to be? When I was here last September along with Lucas and Chris from the Edinburgh Whiskey Blog, you kind of used us as guinea pigs for this one, didn't you?
Well, Mark. I'll have to put my hands up and say that's correct. The Barry Crockett legacy has been in the pipeline, obviously, for some time. It just doesn't appear overnight. And it's interesting to see what other people think of, let's call it, work in progress. And you know, we don't just sit back on our laurels and say we're good at this, let's just do this. I mean, we like to get some feedback from the consumers as well, and you know, it's nice just to get a feel of what people appreciate in their whiskey, and therefore we always pay attention to what the critics have to say. And yeah, I mean, you were complimentary back then, and here we have it.
And let's put this in perspective. When I was here with the guys, with Chris and Lucas back in late September, we were having dinner at the Distiller's Cottage with you, Dave, and Barry, and you pulled out what you called Prototype F, and you said, I want you guys to try this. And as I recall, we said it was a little bit dry on the finish. You went back and tweaked it after that, right?
Yeah, I mean, that was, as I say, it was work in progress. It was one of the initial prototypes. And yeah, the profile of the casks that we had put together in that particular prototype was really on a trial basis. And it's nice to get the feedback from people like yourself, Mark, that, you know, the whole pot still scene at the minute has got a very enthusiastic following. So I mean, you've got to acknowledge that there are people there. You've got to acknowledge what they would like to see in their whiskey, and you know, we moved on from there.
I want to ask you what you're working on right now, but tell me how hard it was to, especially with the Powers John's Lane version, to try to replicate the old style of Powers from the old distillery and to come as close as you could, given that you're not using the same techniques in the same facilities.
Well, yeah, that's correct, Mark. The Powers John's Lane release is something that we've been wanting to do to try and take us back to the provenance of the whole Powers family. And as you say, we're not using the same techniques as they were back in the Powers John's Lane distillery days. But in the John's Lane release, what we have tried to do there is let that particular style of pot still distillate speak for itself. So in doing so, we put together this new product as a single pot still, and letting the distillate make the statement, and using the cask influence, a little bit of sherry cask, a little bit of bourbon cask, just as balancing tools. But the body of that formulation is really coming from in the cask mix is refill casks, which subdued the cask influence to an extent, to the extent that it allows the pot still, the basic pot still characteristics shine through. And I think we've achieved that pretty well with the John's Lane release.
There will be a third new release later on this year. It'll carry the Redbreast label, but no other hints have been dropped. In the interests of disclosure, I was one of several whiskey writers invited to attend the event at Middleton this week as the guest of Irish Distillers. Now, it's not the only distiller in Ireland that's releasing new whiskey this week. As I was packing to leave, the Whiskey Fairy, or in this case, the Whiskey Leprechaun, delivered a package from Cooley with a new 18-year-old version of its Kilbeggan Irish whiskey. This one's a blend of pot still and grain whiskies from Cooley's distillery northeast of Dublin. Just 4,000 bottles are available. I'll have tasting notes for all three of these whiskies later in the What I'm Tasting This Week department. In other news, quarterly profit figures for three of the largest whiskey producers are out. Diageo and Pernod Ricard both beat estimates for their third quarters based on strong sales in Asia and the Americas, while sales in Europe continue to lag. Meanwhile, the Beam Global unit of Fortune Brands showed a 25.5% profit increase for its first quarter on the basis of stronger-than-expected sales in the U.S., the U.K., Spain, Germany, Australia, and India. Beam is benefiting from increased European interest in bourbon, which is a weak spot for Diageo. Pernod Ricard left the bourbon business a couple of years ago when it sold Wild Turkey to Campari. By the way, Fortune Brands executives still plan to complete their breakup of the company by the end of the year, with the golf and home improvement units to be spun off or sold. At that point, the company's name will change to Beam, Inc. The Scotch Whiskey Association has won its first legal case stemming from the 2009 Scotch Whiskey Law after Reynald & Son agreed to stop passing off spirits as Scotch Whiskey. The SWA filed a lawsuit in Scotland's court system accusing Reynald of advertising 14 brands as Scotch Whiskey when they were actually produced in Panama by a company called Scottish Spirits and were nothing but unaged neutral spirit and flavorings. By the way, Scottish Spirits is the same company that released a 12-ounce can of so-called Scotch whiskey in Panama in January. I mentioned that back in episode 299. According to JustDrinks.com, a lawyer for Reynald & Sons blamed a link on the company's website to the Scottish Spirits products. That company is owned by friends and former colleagues of Reynald's owner. The link has been removed. Finally, Animal Kingdom won Saturday's Kentucky Derby, but the Heart of a Horse Foundation came out a big winner as well. It's the designated charity for Woodford Reserve's annual $1,000 mint julep sale. 103 Tiffany Sterling Silver Mint Julep cups sold for $1,000 each, and three additional cups with 24-karat gold trim were auctioned off. The winning bids totaled $9,100. The total raised for the Heart of a Horse Foundation, $112,100. And that's the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie, unnecessarily well-made. Let's look at the emails of the week now, brought to you this time around by Highland Park. Had a lot of comments about the last episode and Buffalo Trace's Single Oak Project bourbons. Angelo Veneziano from just down the road in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, had this question. What are they going to do with all of the used barrels? Since Scottish distillers buy up the vast majority of these used barrels, I was wondering if they were working on a collaboration with any of them. Could make for an interesting Old World, New World whiskey project. Let me know your thoughts. We didn't address it during the segment in the last episode, but Buffalo Trace plans to keep all of those barrels and is also keeping the so-called lily pad sections of the trunks that were cut at ground level. No word yet on what will be done with them in the future. As I mentioned last time, it'll be nearly impossible for anyone to collect a full set of all 192 bottles. Tim Davis in Texas posted this on the WhiskeyCast Facebook page. The ones that are extra good will spawn a stockpiling and hoarding race to make Pappy Hunts look like a quest for Jim Beam White. Oh well, at least whatever is the best will become a full-time expression in about 10 years. Carl Shields posted this comment on the WhiskeyCast Facebook page. Wonderful podcast on this. I can't stress how much I love the science behind this. Curious about one comment you made. You talked about potential nutrients in the wood, particularly in the bottom half of the tree versus the upper half. Do you know if Buffalo Trace has conducted any chemical analysis of the wood, like neutron activation, mass spectrometry, or isotope analysis, and compared the differences between the two? Well, I emailed that question to Buffalo Trace master distiller Harlan Wheatley. Here's what he told me, quote, "We have worked with our wood supplier on some chemical analysis of the wood, but it certainly wasn't 100% comprehensive. We did some research of the lignin and tannin differences of the tops and bottoms of the oaks, which in turn represents the vanillin, syringaldehyde, and ellagic acid production that surfaces in the flavoring components of our whiskey. Much more to do, though." And I suspect you'll be seeing more details on that research coming out on the Single Oak Project's website over the next 4 years. Finally, I heard from Lisa Eddins. She's the daughter-in-law of Ronnie Eddins, the longtime warehouse manager at Buffalo Trace who inspired the Single Oak Project, but died last winter of cancer just a few months before it was completed. She and her husband Mark, Ronnie's son, were at the distillery for the tree planting ceremony as well, and here's what she had to say. "Ronnie would have been so honored to know that his work at Buffalo Trace has impacted so many people. He always said that he was amazed people would honor him or even know who he was. Ronnie fought a hard battle and wanted to live long enough to see this project unveiled, but it was not meant to be. I'm sure he is smiling down from above and is very pleased with all the hard work that Mark Brown, Harlan Wheatley, and others have put into this project to make it a success. His work at Buffalo Trace was his passion, and he admired and respected all of his co-workers. Thanks, Lisa." And they certainly admired and respected Ronnie as well. If you have something you'd like to share with the thousands of WhiskeyCast listeners and community members around the world, you can post on the WhiskeyCast Facebook page or just email me. My address is comments@whiskeycast.com. The emails of the week are brought to you this time around by Highland Park.
Hello, this is Jerry Tosh of Highland Park, the makers of the best spirit in the world. If you'd like to go onto the WhiskeyCast website and click on the banner, then it'll take you to the inner circle and sign up, and we'll send you as much information about Highland Park as you'd ever need to know.
Time now to check the calendar of events brought to you, as always, by Laphroaig. A lot of talk while I was over in Ireland about the first Whiskey Live Dublin coming up this Saturday. It's also the day of the Spirit of Toronto Festival. This coming weekend is also the Limburg Whiskey Fair in Germany, Erin in the Square in Glasgow's George Square, and the Manhattan Cocktail Classic in New York City. Springbank Distillery's annual open day is May 19th in Campbellton, and the Isla Festival of Malt and Music runs from the 21st through the 28th. The Queensland Whiskey Expo is May 31st in Brisbane, Australia, and the Dundee Dell in Omaha, Nebraska has single malt tastings on June 5th and June 9th. Finally, the annual Bourbon and Bowties benefit for Crozer Children's Hospital is June 16th in Louisville. You'll find a full calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website. It's brought to you by Laphroaig. Become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Isla. This week's WhiskeyCast In Depth is brought to you by Glengarry. Let's continue our focus on Irish whiskeys now with some history and a few places you really ought to check out if you visit Dublin. Back in the day, Irish pot still whiskey was considered the world's finest, most widely sold around the world too. But several factors changed all that. The invention of the coffee still made it possible to distill grain whiskey cheaply. The refusal of Ireland's distillers to even consider the output of the coffee stills as real whiskey, and Scottish blenders combining malt whiskies with grain whiskies from the coffee stills to create blended Scotch whiskey. When Alfred Barnard wrote his classic book, The Whiskey Distilleries of the United Kingdom, in 1886, there were 28 whiskey distilleries in Ireland. Bushmills is the only one of those 28 still distilling today, although Cooley does fire up the stills at the old Locks Distillery in Kilbeggan occasionally. Cooley's main distillery in Riverstown supplies almost all of its whiskey, and the Irish distiller's Middleton Distillery in Cork is Ireland's largest. It replaced what's now known as Old Middleton Distillery and two distilleries in Dublin, the Powers Distillery on John's Lane and the Jameson Distillery on Bow Street. While the old Middleton Distillery was turned into a visitor's center, the Powers Distillery is long gone, and the old Jameson Distillery nearly met the same fate. It closed in 1971, but what's left of the distillery is now a thriving visitor's center. Christopher Goggins took me on a tour the other day.
After moving away from here, we abandoned pretty much all of the site, and this is the one remaining building that's still standing today. So what we show people on the tour here is a recreation of the old-fashioned process.
How much of the old building and the old distillery is left? Because I know that there's a lot of new development, new construction around here.
Absolutely, yeah. Now, there are a few of the older buildings still standing in and around, but this is the one that's still in our possession. You know, anything else would have been taken over by various other companies over the years.
How much of it is left? What was done in this building?
This originally was the fermentation building at the distillery, which is something we'll be talking about a little more on the tour as we go around. But this is, as far as I'm aware, the only one that we're still in possession of. In terms of exactly how many buildings there are still standing, I'm not 100% sure, I have to say.
Why did they decide to move out of downtown Dublin?
You've actually kind of answered the question for yourself there a little bit, because obviously trying to get raw materials and ingredients in and then whiskey out in what was becoming a much busier city centre was becoming increasingly difficult for us. And also the fact that there was just a larger scope for expansion down at the distillery in Middleton, which is something we're looking into at the moment. Just with the increasing demand for Jameson, space was becoming an issue. And obviously in city centre Dublin, space is always at a premium. So it just made more sense long term to move to somewhere a little more, with a little more scope for that.
Now, the doors here closed in 1971, and this reopened as a visitor's center in 97. What happened during the interim?
Very little. The visitor center was based literally right across the street from here in something that has also since been redeveloped, and that was called the Irish Whiskey Corner, which kind of took people around the history of not just Jameson, but Irish whiskey as a whole in basically one little room. And obviously as visitor numbers increased, we again needed something larger to deal with that. So in 97, we redeveloped this building into a working visitor centre. And then in 2007, we closed for a further 3 months and invested about another $6 million into the visitor centre to create what you'll be seeing on the tour now in a few minutes.
And how many visitors do you get through here in a year?
It's becoming more difficult to say again, because obviously with the economic climate that we have, but usually we're averaging about 250,000 people through the doors here every year.
And that's down because of the recession a bit?
It's something that has kind of steadied out for us now again, and we are noticing it starting to pick up for us again a little bit, absolutely. But, I mean, like with any industry, we were hit by it a little bit, yeah.
How much fun is it to work here?
As a whiskey drinker, as a Jameson drinker especially, this is kind of my dream job, you know what I mean, in terms of just being able to spread the word and get information out there about it. You know, I like that with the tour here especially, there's no sort of candy coating. We're not here to market to people. We've got a good whiskey with a good story and a great taste, and it sort of sells itself, which makes my job that little bit easier too, you know.
Did you have any family connections to the whiskey business?
I did not. In fact, my first whiskey experience was actually bourbon, which they hate when I tell, but my parents were both big bourbon drinkers, and the first time I came here as a visitor myself during the comparative tasting that we'll be doing a little later, I actually chose the bourbon as my favorite, which I've liked to keep on the down low ever since. But
I don't think we're going to tell anybody about this, but we'll see. But there's some bourbon casks that go into Jameson too, right?
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. About 95% of the casks that we use are ex-bourbon casks coming over from Kentucky, yeah.
So there's a little bit of a link there.
There's a connection, absolutely.
By the way, the stills at the old Jameson Distillery are not the original ones. They came from the old Coleraine Distillery in Antrim. If you're looking to track down obscure Irish whiskies, head to the Trinity College neighborhood of Dublin and the Celtic Whiskey Shop on Dawson Street. It's the only whiskey specialist in Dublin that will also ship outside the country. The shop opened in 2003. Ali Alpine is the general manager.
We were probably too early for Irish whiskey. You know, when we opened, there was no single cask bottlings, there was no limited releases. And to be honest, it was quite hard to fill the shelves, you know, with whiskey. But I mean, the last few years, you know, Cooley have come on. We work very closely with them. We do some special cask finishes, you know, where we give them our casks from wineries we import from, and they put the whiskey in. Middleton, you know, now do single cask for us. Obviously tomorrow they're releasing more pot still whiskies. Bushmills would be the only one that when we started, we got some single, we did actually get some single cask bottlings, and since Diageo have taken over, you know, nothing. But I mean, Irish whiskey's come on leaps and bounds. You know, there's Tim O'Dwyer releasing single malts, the Irishman, Writer's Tears, Nepal Castle just released a 16-year-old. So I mean, the range of Irish whiskies, you know, has probably trebled in the sort of 7 years we've been open.
Are you surprised by the explosion?
Yes and no. I mean, when we first opened, everybody seemed very reticent to do anything. But I think the interest worldwide is huge, you know, and I think it can grow considerably. I mean, I'm surprised there's not more distilleries opening.
Give me a sense of what you have here that, other than your single casks, that would be very difficult for anybody else to find anywhere else.
I mean, Middleton, they do one cask for us every year. So this is the third year we've done a single cask. You know, they've only done, as far as I know, two single casks this year. You know, so it's very hard to find anywhere else. Cooley Distillery, every year, you know, their whiskey is a year older. You know, we usually get the first chance of getting the 17-year-old or the 18-year-old or the 19-year-old. We get products that are only available at the distillery, you know, things like the Cobegan Distillery Reserve malt. So, anything Irish there is, you know, we have it.
You also stock some stuff from across the way over in that other whiskey-producing region, right?
Yes. Well, I'm Scottish myself, and, you know, the range, I suppose, tourists wouldn't be looking for Scotch whiskey when they're in Ireland, but there'd be a lot of Irish people, you know, they like Scotch whiskey, and I suppose we're probably the only place in town that, you know, has a range available. So we deal directly with quite a few people, Beaumore, Springbank, Arran, Benriach, Clendronach, Signatory, Edradour. So, you know, we have good ranges from these people. And then we have all the staples like Lefroy, Glagavill, and... Yes.
And I know that the other main store in town, Mitchell's, sort of moved out of its traditional location, which leaves you as pretty much the main store right in the center heart of Dublin as far as the for tourists who are coming into the city, right?
Yes, I mean, we work very well with Mitchell's. You know, we do the green spot for them. You know, they obviously they always had green spot, but they would never have such an extensive range of other whiskies. And we've just taken on the agency for Nika Japanese whiskies. We do Suntory Japanese. We just got the Amrut whiskies in today. We do the Welsh Pindern, and we've got the Swedish whiskies in next week, like Mira. So I mean, I suppose our range is growing all the time.
One final question: give me an Irish whiskey that is completely underrated, that people would be surprised if they tried it.
Potentially this Lock's 8-year-old single malt is contains, I think, about 5% of peated malt, so it's very, very lightly peated. The malt in it, I'm sure, is a good bit older than 8 years. You know, we've tried it with comparative tastings with Glenfiddich 12-year-old, Glenlivet 12-year-old, things like that, and this beats them hands down. It's, you know, €35, lovely whiskey.
In Ireland, they talk about someone having the gift of gab. Well, you're about to meet one of those people. Michael Hedigan's family has owned the Brian Boru Pub on Prospect Road in Dublin's Glasnevin neighborhood for more than 100 years. That's a long time, and a lot of things happened along the way.
Patrick Hedigan came from Galbalee, County Limerick, to Dublin and worked in Sandy Mountain, a pub there. And he left there in 1890 or something. He worked there and for a number of years and became manager of it, and then he bought the Brian Boru 1904, where he did it all up, and a number of months later then he sent out flyers, which we found in 1994 when we were doing up the upstairs here. We found some of the flyers in the attic, and they were notifying all the people of his recent purchase and that he had done the place up, and he was open for business and was delighted to sell all these great whiskies and sherries and ports and bottled beers and all this. So he bottled Bass, Stout, Smithicks, bottled all sorts of things for years. And at one stage he supplied the RDS, which is the showgrounds in Bald Bridge. And one of the things that you're more interested in is the whiskey. And from the word go, bought his whiskey from Powers and Jemison when it was produced, and then would hold it in bond for maybe 7 years, maybe 10 years, some of it at the time. And then it was delivered to the Brian Boru when you wanted a hogshead. And as I was showing you there, the 5-gallon drum and the whiskey pump, which I use myself as well, it was here since, that pump is there since 1904, I'd say, anyway. And so you pump it out, add the testers to see how much it come in at probably 102 to 106 proof. So you had to bring it down to 30 underproof, which is the 70 degrees. And so you worked it out by testing the strength and all that, sorry, and you get how much water you need to put into it. Then you'd have poured all your whiskey into this big 150-gallon vat, of which we had two in the cellar, and you'd mix the water in then, and then you'd have to toss it, as they said. So you'd fill the 5-gallon jug 20 times and toss it in over, up, and all that sort of stuff. So then you let it set. You tested it then to see if you're right. And if you weren't right, you had to do another little bit of water. It wouldn't want to be the wrong way, but it was rarely that it would happen. You'd have, you might have to put another bit of water and re-toss it. But as you did it more, you rarely made a mistake, actually. You had it pretty accurate. And then we used to add our own colour. And he had his own recipe where he used to store the whiskey in sherry casks, as probably a lot of people did at the time. But Pat Hedigan at the time used to have his own little secret recipe where he added a little bit of extra sherry to the whiskey. And we always had the whiskey in the Brian Boru was always a lovely, lovely colour, dark colour. And then we had the little barrels behind the counter, 3-gallon barrels. And there were four of them here when I started, and you'd fill them. So we would then fill the customer's small whiskey, or a ball of malt, as it was called, a large whiskey. You'd fill that and pour it into the glass. And that was the first time it ever touched glass, was when the customer bought it. And so he became very famous for his whiskey, as did a lot of pubs, but the Brian Boru in particular was famous for whiskey, for the lovely colour, the lovely flavour. It always, people, which we wouldn't have been saying to them then what we were doing with it, but it was always a lovely flavour and colour, and so it became very popular. And he was here until 1939, and then my father took over. And in the Second World War, Dad was approached by a guy to that he could have sold the entire stock of whiskey he had in bond for probably more, 3 or 4 times what he'd have ever got behind the counter. But this guy had bought a shipload of fruit out on the sea or something. He was called Mincemeat Joe, was his name, but he specialised in this buying stuff and then selling it on. So Dad decided at that stage that he wouldn't sell anything, he'd keep it. And he was very proud of the fact that he never ran out of whiskey during the Second World War, and he couldn't get whiskey in Dublin at the time. So we came to ration it, where they bring in a gallon of whiskey in the evening, or 2 gallons maybe, and there'd be customers lined up waiting to get their ball of malt. And it was that, you talk about customer service and things like, and looking after your customers, this is what he felt was looking after them. And he was proven right, because for many, many years afterwards, people came in and said, oh, we always got the whiskey here. And there's still people coming in remembering the whiskey that was here. So Irish Distillers grew from Powers and Jemison, were all separate companies, which right into the 60s, and Cork Gin and all them, Paddy down in Cork. And they all joined together around 1966, 67. And around 68, 9, they stopped supplying bulk whiskey to pubs. It was probably one of the first things they did. So we had in stock enough whiskey to last us. My father died on the 1st of October, 73, and we had enough whiskey to last until virtually the end of the year. We ran out just in December. So you might as well say from 1904 to 1974, the Brian Boru served whiskey from the wood, all racked off, bonded by ourselves and racked off on the premises.
And this was fairly commonplace at the time for Irish bars, right?
It was at the later stages, no, it wasn't. No, there was probably 3 or 4 pubs in Dublin that were selling whiskey from the wood, and or racking it off themselves. Not all of them would have sold it from, I think we would have been one of the only ones from wooden barrels. One or two others had it. But in times before that, probably a lot of pubs might have done it, but not all. And so it was just a nice, famous touch to the pub. And Frank O'Reilly, who was the chairman of Powers at the time, came out here to meet my father towards the end of when he was running out to see him, and he gave him a little silver ashtray, which I still have, 1966 silver. It was commemorating the 1916-66, the 50 years of the 1916 rising. So it was a great thing then. Now, we sold a lot of whiskey at that stage, so you could afford to do it. Now you really couldn't afford to have whiskey, 3 gallons of whiskey sitting in a little wooden barrel, because it evaporates quite a bit, you know. And but at the times that we're in it, like I have, even myself in the late 60s, was you'd be bringing in on a Monday morning, you might bring in 10, 12 gallons of whiskey, and you'd be replacing it on possibly Wednesday, you'd be topping it up another 8 or 9 gallons, you know. So you were selling a good bit of whiskey. And back in the older times, in old transfer books from the stores, you can see where they were bringing in 12 gallons of whiskey on a Monday and 10 on a Tuesday and this sort of stuff, because there was very little other spirits around, you know. So big business at the time, yeah.
What was it like back then when you were growing up here, as this era was coming to an end? What was it like here in the pub?
Business in general, you mean?
Yeah. Yeah. What would it be like on a typical night?
Oh, it'd be busy. Yeah, every day was busy. And the Brian Boru is now a half a kilometre, it's less than half a mile from Glasnevin Cemetery. So we always did a funeral business, whereas people would come back to the pub after funerals. And at that, up to the early 70s, they would have just arrived. Maybe into the mid-70s, they would have just arrived after a funeral. You might have 50 people walk in the door, or 60, or 70, or 80, or whatever the hell it was. And they'd walk in and they'd start ordering, not much food at that time, but they'd have drinks. And the odd time I served a funeral where the guy came in and he said, open 6 bottles of whiskey there and a few bottles of vodka or gin or whatever, and we'd have them on the counter and we'd pour them out for them. So that was the way he wanted to do it. But in the main, they just bought round for round. But so I started working here around 1962, but I was only 12 in school, working on a Sunday morning on the floor. And that was by choice. It wasn't my older brothers would have worked here, so of course I couldn't wait to get in. And on a Sunday morning especially, was a special time for generations of men at the time, more so than the ladies. They'd come out, you might have the grandfather, father, and the son would come in for a few drinks. The son could be young, 12, 15 or whatever, be drinking a mineral, but the lads. So Sunday mornings was a sort of special time, because you opened from 12:30 to 2, and then you closed until 5 o'clock into the early 60s, then it became 4 to 11, and it was 5 to 9 before that. So Sunday morning was a special session for the family going out, and you did have women, but I'm saying a lot of them fellas would be out, have the few jars, go home and have the lunch, and then they'll be back out later that evening as well. So Sunday was always a busy day, but every day was a fairly busy day here. You would have had, as I say, the funeral groups. We had a lot of businessmen at that time who would have a lot of them would have gone home for their lunch. So in the little, what's now the bar, was a small little lounge, and you'd have 8 or 10 or 12 fellas there on their way home to lunch, having a drink. And then they go home and have the lunch, maybe go back into town afterwards. I remember one man used to work in O'Connell Street in one of the offices, and he used to hop off the bus outside here, come in and have his Jameson Crest at 10, back out onto the other bus and home to Ballymun Avenue, and then an hour later back into town. And a lot of business guys did the same. And then, of course, they sort of, and there'll be a few retired businessmen. So there was always a good buzz in the place, you know. And, of course, at that time then, in the mornings, you had the porters at the time used to clean the premises, then the bar staff would be in. And you'd have to bottle your own Guinness. We'd be racking off our whiskey. You'd be bottling our own whiskey down from the bottle, the half bottle, the naggin size, and even down to the babies. You got 64 babies, baby powers, out of a gallon of whiskey. And you used to put three little labels on the front of the little bottle and a cap, a cork into it, and then you put this, what they call a capsule over it, little paper thing that go across. So you had to put four pieces of paper onto a baby power bottle. It was quite amazing, you know. And we used to sell a good bit of that too. Like at that time, the pubs probably did the takeaway business rather than off-licences only grew in the late 60s, really. And so biz was good at that time, and you'd be very proud of your whiskey and your stout, if your bottle stout was done right, you know. And back, as I mentioned earlier, the previous times when they used to bottle their own Bass, you'd have blue triangle Bass and red triangle Bass. And those things were more skill than the bottling of the stout. Because in the 20s, this was an old manager who had worked here for 50 years, he used to tell me, they'd have to go in and they'd have the bottles facing down on the cork, and then they'd turn them after a week, couple of weeks. You'd usually bottle a hogshead of stout and you'd keep it for possibly six weeks maybe, before you'd use it. So we might have in the stores about 7 or 8 hogsheads of stout done up in trays of, for some reason, the tray used to hold 7 dozen and 11 bottles, and you put the other one in, up with 7 dozen and 11 bottles, and you used to get 71 dozen out of a tray, out of a hogshead of Guinness, 72 dozen basically. So you'd have a lot of bottles of stout, and then pint bottles, you'd have done some of them as well. And then you'd have your whiskey, and you'd be, so out the back, the porters be going out collecting bottles from customers, and the bottles you use yourself, they'd be washing them. They'd have big tanks to soak them in, and then they'd have to wash the bottles with this brush that would be automated that would go into them. Then he'd be having them turned upside down and drying for, so they'd be all gleaming. And he used to bottle your hogshead of stout once a week, and then it'd be stored. You'd bottle it, label it, cork it, and then you'd store it for 6 weeks, and then the whiskey was similar. And but the custom then in the, I mean, when I started, say, and before I started, I suppose in the mid-50s, a lot of pubs would have been predominantly male customers at the time, because a lot of women probably didn't drink out much of those things. There would have been some women, and there would have been certain pubs would have, they all catered for them, I suppose, but in some cases it didn't really happen that much. But certainly late 50s, early 60s, the girls started coming into the pubs, which was brilliant, because 50% of the population was going to be a good potential customers, you know.
Right.
So that began to grow, and in the 60s, a lot of the cocktail lounges, they were called, or the, you did up your lounges much more nicely, you know, because the women would have, they would have been very basic, but very clean and very nice places, with linoleum floors and all this sort of stuff, and tile floors before carpets started coming in. So they called them the cocktail lounge or the lounge, and the girls started coming in. And from my recollection, starting out in the early 60s doing the floor, we used to have groups of guys and girls in the back lounge there on a Saturday night. The place would be jammed. And the girls at that stage, we used to have a lot of baby sham. The little bottles of baby sham, and you'd serve it in a champagne glass with a cherry in the side of it. And champagne, we used to have, you might have had 10 cases of 2 dozen cases of baby sham ordered in the week. And then the next thing they moved on to was bottles of Carlsberg that came out. This is my recollection in the 60s anyway. And that went on for a while, and then suddenly vodka became the thing, and they never looked back. The baby sham was gone by the board then, and vodkas and white vodka and tonic, vodka and coke was a great drink for girls, you know, and everything. So then late 60s, we started doing, well, we would have been doing sandwiches and soup even during the, you know, 60s. We always did sandwiches, I suppose, because we always had a grocery shop there till after the war, the Second World War. So they'd be making bully beef sandwiches, as the old manager used to say, for some of the funerals years before. But in the 70s, we started starting into the soup and sandwiches, and lunchtime became more popular in pubs. So by the mid-70s, I was doing hot lunches and salads here. And we were probably, there was the Royal Oak down the road, which is now gone. That pub used to do hot lunches as well. And there was only the two of us. So it got to be very busy. The new industrial estate opened up beside us. And so that sort of, the food started to grow. And then we redid the place, I would say, from Pat Hedigan doing it up in 1904, I'm sure they did a job in the 30s. The 50s was a job I would have seen the results of, but we did a job in 62 here, did a big job in 1976 myself, did another one in 86, 87, and then in 94 I redid the upstairs here and redid some of the downstairs as well. And then in 2000 and something, we did another paint job, and a few 2008 then we redid the whole place again. That was just decoration. Some of the others were structural changes, putting on the conservatory, the garden, all this sort of stuff. So you've tried to keep moving with the times and at the same time being totally respectful of the old building that we have. The Brian Brew is a lovely old pub, and in the 80s I replaced dados, and the wall would have had the dado going all the way down, which was done in the 50s in a lovely winey formica thing. And the counter, you'll still see the bottom of the counter still has some of that formica on it, which I didn't change because the top of the counter has this black, can't think of the word now. It's a beautiful thing when you polish it up. It's like glass, vitrolite it is, black vitrolite. And it's, you polish that up, it's like a mirror. It's gorgeous. So there's brass and the vitrolite, and then there's the stuff from the walls. In 87, I replaced all of the stuff, a lot of it, with mahogany. So the place is a very traditional pub now, and it's only getting better every year that goes by. So that, then with that, we put in carveries in the 80s and did evening menus, and now food is a big part of our business. Would be the drinks would be the majority of it, but we do a lot of good food, and that's the trick, is that it's good, fresh food, all cooked on the premises and with great care and attention, as is the pint, of course. Great TLC when you're pulling a pint or serving food, you know, it's all about the service, really, you know, and giving customers good service. And that then moves on, brings you on to the, when you've got all the quality right, you have the pub, lovely old pub, great quality to it. And then the most important thing after that, from my experience, and something that I've always done from the day I started, was I hate to see people waiting. I love to give people good service. So customer service is number one, I think, which builds the reputation of the place. And the key to that is good staff who are friendly and give genuine welcome to people. That it's not, you know, it's a genuine warm welcome that people get coming in the door. They get excellent professional service and the touches of nice few words for everybody, you know, and it gives repeat business. So that's brought the Brian Brew up to 2000, and now we're going along with a lovely new food menu, all fresh fish and fresh food, and we have regenerated. We've just grown all the time with the business, and you keep changing, but at the same time everything changes and nothing changes, because you still go back to the basic model is it's quality, service and value. And value to me is not all about price. It's about somebody going out the door and not even realizing, but saying, God, I had a good night there. Or the next day they say, gee, we'll go back to the Brian Brew, because they don't know why, but they had a great night. And that's basically the way it is. And long may we continue, hopefully. And now we're going to, we've joined the Whiskey Corner. Or isn't it the
Whiskey Trail?
The Whiskey Trail with Heidi. And we've done that to try and hone back in. And we're creating a whiskey room in the Brian Brew with some of our old, the whiskey pump and all the jugs. I have all the old whiskey jugs and all that. And getting new, all this nice selection of whiskies that we'll have. And we'll have this little room where we can bring tourists who might want to have a tasting. So we can organise a tasting. And that's downstairs. And in this room that we're in here, we created a number of years ago, of course, we've been mentioned in James Joyce and Ulysses, and we're mentioned in Strumpet City is another book. Mentioned a number of different things. Martin Fay of the Chieftains in 1973 or 4 put on Chieftain 7 LP, he dedicated one of the songs, he called it Hedigan's Fancy, after his famous local pub. And or his favourite local pub, and he so that was that. And but the Joycean connection, we do readings and all that on Bloomsday every year, and it's getting bigger and bigger all the time. And there's a lot of connections with the Joyce Centre in Georgia Street. And 2 years ago, we made a DVD on the premises of the Dublin Writers' Room, is what we call it. And it's at the Brian Brew. And we did a piece from a lot of the plays by Joyce, O'Casey, Singh, Brendan Behan, and Roddy Doyle. We did a piece on the commitments. So we have actors acting out pieces from The Importance of Being Earnest, The Playboy of the Western World. And we use a few actors, and we use one girl who works here still. She's an actress, so she's part of it. Claire is part of that. And we made this DVD, which if you had time, or I might take your address and I'll send you one. And it's a great thing. And we use that to show to tourists. So we're moving. We had that writer's room downstairs, but now we're going to turn that room into the whiskey room. And we're going to turn this room into the writer's room. And we'll have the DVD there. So it's about 40 minutes long. So it's, again, it's things for... It's broadening the scope of the place and giving people, when they come, you're giving them something, you're added value, sort of, you're looking after the tourists and that sort of stuff. And now Glasnevin Cemetery have created a museum down there, which is terrific. They won an award in an American thing and recently, which is brilliant. And of course, you have the museum down in Croke Park. So we're in around a lot of good things happening. So. Yeah.
What was it like when you got the word from Powers and Jameson and everybody at Irish Distillers that they were going to stop selling whiskey in bulk, and your customers realized that things were about to change?
Yes, it was actually in 1969 we'd have got that message, and we had enough whiskey to last us till the end of 73 into just early 74, and I never rationed it either. I just used it as it was, and a lot of disappointment, yeah, a lot of, and even the, now as I said, there was probably only about two other publicans still doing whiskey like that. The Ryan's in Park 8th Street used to have, although they weren't doing it till the end, I don't think, and Sheery's in Dorset Street, Mick Sheery and Pat Sheery, they used to do their own whiskey. I think they were finished before us. I think we were one of the last pubs to do whiskey. The Palace Bar probably had it in times before that as well. And so a lot of disappointment, I suppose. And at the same time, you realise a few years later that, as I said, it was a good few years later now that whiskey started, the volume of it dropping a little bit. Probably when one of the budgets, when they started putting up huge, 1 year, Richie Ryan brought in this budget. They called him Richie Ruin after it because he ruined the trade by putting a 30% increase between VAT and excise duty. So the pint and the whiskey went up by 30% in a month. It was a huge blow. And a lot of people missed it. And at the time, I kept the last 3 or 4 gallons and I bottled it into 40-ounce bottles, saying, I will put that into my old bottles. And I still have the whiskey. And it was tested a number of years ago by one of the guys in Paris, and he said it was still fine. So I still have it. I must taste a bit myself someday. But it'll be interesting now to create this room. One of the big regrets, of course, I have is that we had this lovely whiskey cellar with these 250-gallon vats and another smaller 30-40-gallon one for Power or for Jameson. And I never took one photograph of myself racking off the whiskey or emptying the 5-gallon jug or the vats. And I minded them until we were doing the job in 87. I had to move them in 76. I had to move them to a farmhouse we had. And when my mother sold that, there was nowhere we could put them. So unfortunately, we don't have any photographs of that, which is a pity. I have a lot of old photographs, but nothing of that. So there was disappointment, and but things move on. And now, of course, the whiskey has moved into quality. The quality of whiskies is just superb now. I mean, the range that Irish distillers have is fantastic. And the old Bushmills one, which they've sold, it's now part of Diageo. And the Redbreast was another one that was a famous Dublin whiskey. You had Dublin Jameson at that time too, which we would have bought from Kelly's. It was our wholesalers. And they would have bottled that in a similar way to we did ours. But it was called Dublin Jameson. Jameson was a very Dublin whiskey. Gold Label would have been more around the country. And the Dublin Jameson was a nice whiskey as well. We probably would have sold a lot more of that then after, when we ran out of our own. But the Redbreast was the other one I was going to say. Redbreast was bottled by Gilby's, which was an independent company, and they would have bought their basic whiskey spirit from Irish Distillers. And then in 1988, Irish Distillers, Guinness and C&C put together a bid, hostile bid, to take over Irish Distillers, because it was sort of humming along and wasn't good company. But so this was horror to the guys in Irish Distillers, so they fought it hugely, and they actually won. And in the end, Pernod Ricard bought Irish Distillers with their blessing. And at that time then, Redbreast, which was a very, not a huge volume of whiskey, but a lot of people liked their Redbreast. And this was bottled by Gilby's. So the first thing Irish Distillers did was stop supplying Gilby's with the whiskey base to make their Redbreast. So that means Redbreast went by the wayside. It's back now. So that went on. And then since then, you have the Middletons and all those. And then, as I said, Irish Distillers moved on. And Jameson now is a massive worldwide brand. It's huge. It's a great brand. And they've all the extra, the gold, the Jameson 1780, the Jameson 12-year-old, which is lovely, and the Powers 12-year-olds. And likewise with a lot of other whiskies, the quality is getting better and better all the time. So it's a very interesting market, and people love to come in and talk about it. And it's nice to be able to give them a bit of history of having done it yourself. And I'd probably be one of the few people around who actually did rack it off myself up to 73. So I'm always interested in talking about it. And so we're very interested now to go with Heidi into the whiskey trail and give a better choice of whiskey. And we look forward to doing these whiskey tastings in conjunction with Irish Distillers and Heidi and the whiskey trail. And in the early 90s, a man called John Teeling bought Cooley Distillery, which was actually only agricultural alcohol they were making at one time. But it was going into liquidation, and John moved in and bought it. And he has turned that around, even though Irish Distillers were going to buy it at one stage, which was probably his initial plan for it. It didn't happen. And John has now turned that into fantastic distillery with all lovely Kilbeggan and Cooley whiskies, and he has a number of different whiskies, single malt and all that sort of stuff. So there's another Irish brand, which is actually good, because now we've a few Irish distillers, you know, we're operating. Long may it continue. The Ishka Ba, as they call it, or Ishka, is it? Yeah, the firewater anyway was the, some of them talking about the whiskey. In the barrel, the Powers we did was called Three Swallow White Label Whiskey. I have a few mirrors downstairs, I'll show you them. And we've one old mirror down the front lounge there, the DWD. It was a distillery on Jones's Road. And this mirror is fantastic. It's the amount of gold leaf on it is terrific. And we have the old Powers mirrors, which we used to have in our front windows here. And they were all lovely gold and the work that went into them and that sort of thing. So anyway.
Back then, would you have been loyal to one distillery or one distillery group to get your whiskey? Or would you have worked with, in the pre-Irish distiller days, would you have worked with Jameson and Powers and the Paddy folks down in Cork and Bushmills and gotten whiskey from more than one distillery?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we had all the Irish whiskeys. You would have had Paddy, Powers, Jameson. You probably had the Redbreasts. You'd had the Dublin Jameson. Now, in the 50s and that, you'd have been, you wouldn't have had too many outside the gold. We wouldn't have probably had the gold label. We might have had a few bottles of gold label because mainly the whiskey we sold was our own. And you would have had Jameson, or you would have had Jameson outside of it. There was some little blip somewhere in the, we used to do a lot more of the Jameson in the wood. And at some point there was some little row of some sort, so we went more with the Powers at that stage. But we would have, Jameson mightn't have been here for a while then, but it was back then. And yes, we would have done all the Irish whiskies. And when they joined up then, of course, you had Cork Distillery's own Paddy. And you'd have had the Kilbeggan, of course, too. Wouldn't have been very big now around Dublin probably at the time. But we would have had all the Irish whiskies. And the Scotch ones, of course, then would have gone quite well as well. You know, there's a lot of Scotch whiskey sold too. It's sort of not selling massive amounts now. It sells, you know. But we would have stocked them all, yeah.
Are you surprised by the comeback in Irish whiskey and the growth we've seen over the last 5 to 10 years?
Well, if you went back to when Irish distillers were taken over, I remember going to thing, and that they had made the decision at that stage that they were making Jameson their international brand, and they put a huge amount of effort. And I think that the connection with Pernod Ricard was instrumental in making that work then. And as they went on, then Irish distillers had Bushmills as well, and they looked after Bushmills quite well because it did come on, and they brought on a few new brands in it, or the older ones, you know. And so not pleasantly surprised that it actually has, they're actually doing so well at the moment. It's quite amazing, yeah. And I'm delighted. It's lovely to see Irish whiskey. I mean, years ago you'd go away, you might see an odd bottle of Jameson. Now you see it everywhere, you know. I mean, and people coming here to look at it and all that. And it's fantastic achievement, yeah. And it's all born out of quality, of course, you know. And of course, the good marketing and all that. But they set out to do that, and they did achieve it, yeah, pretty well. Obviously, the connection with Pernod Ricard was great. And Guinness, then, on the other hand, with their whiskies, and they have now got the Bushmills, which I think they're a bit over the moon about getting as well. And it's actually the oldest distillery in the country, I think. So their brands are lovely too. And but it's great to see the Jameson. And now they're working on the Powers Go label. They sort of let Powers and Paddy drift along for many years. And then they suddenly realised that when these brands were worth a lot of money. So they've now, I think when, I can't remember the exact price that Irish distillers went for at the time, but there was talk, was it 50 million a brand or something like that at the time. But now the Powers is coming on very well, and Powers used to be the national brand in Ireland. Powers was the more popular. Not quite sure where that stands now. The Paddy is working away along, but it wouldn't be anything like the other brands. And it's it's the 12-year-olds and the 18-year-olds and the gold ones and the special 800 whiskies and all these. That's what I think is terrific, you know, and then all these other ones that you can get that are just so interesting and nice to taste, you know. Everybody likes a little drop of whiskey. Ball of malt, call it the hot whiskey, another great drink. You know, a properly made hot whiskey, properly made Irish coffee, fantastic drinks. But they have to be properly made. Heat the glass, serve them correctly, you know. You make a bit of a fuss over them too. It's like anything, you know, it's all about the presentation of it and whatever. But I think it's fantastic. The Irish whiskies, they're really great now, yeah. And I'm looking forward now to getting more into our own whiskey room. I think we're the first pub to have a whiskey room and do this sort of thing, but we're looking forward to it anyway.
There's a link for the Brian Boru at the Whiskey Cast website, along with the Old Jameson Distillery and the Celtic Whiskey Shop. Also, if you're flying through Dublin, the new Terminal 2 at Dublin's airport has the Irish Whiskey Shop, with more than 60 different Irish whiskies from all of Ireland's distilleries. I'd like to thank Heidi Donnellan of the Irish Whiskey Trail for her help this week. She's the one who introduced me to Michael and Dally. There's a link to the Ireland Whiskey Trail website at the WhiskeyCast website. This week's WhiskeyCast In Depth is brought to you by Glengarry. Non-chill filtered, full Highland character. Let's start off the What I'm Tasting This Week department with the two new whiskies in the Single Pot Still Irish Whiskies of Middleton Collection. The Powers John's Lane is bottled at 46% ABV and uses older bourbon casks with just a touch of sherry casks. The nose is earthy with an aroma of old leather book bindings, wood, dust, pipe tobacco, and some pepperiness. The taste is robust and peppery with caramel, dark chocolate, and hints of honey to balance out the spiciness. The finish lingers nicely with that same balance. It's an outstanding whiskey. I'm scoring the Powers John's Lane a 93. Now, as we heard earlier, I had the chance to taste a prototype of the Middleton Barry Crockett Legacy last fall. The final version is even better. Again, it's bottled at 46% with a mix of first-fill bourbon casks and virgin oak. The nose is subtle and elegant with lime and pear notes, muted spices, vanilla, and toasted almonds. The taste is thick and chewy, starts off peppery, then fades to reveal citrusy lime and grapefruit notes with just a touch of vanilla. The finish is complex, creamy, and smooth. I'm scoring the Middleton Barry Crockett Legacy a 94. Finally, the Kilbeggan 18 is the big brother of Cooley's Kilbeggan 15, which won a number of awards recently, and I scored it a 92 last year. It's bottled at 40% ABV. The nose is subtle and smooth with allspice, honey, and touches of ginger and nutmeg. The taste is creamy with a slight tartness at first, followed by a slow, spicy buildup of cinnamon, tempered with honey, and a very subtle touch of grapefruit underneath. The finish lingers well with honey and a touch of allspice. I'm giving the Kilbeggan 18 a score of 92. You'll find all of my tasting notes in the free WhiskeyCast smartphone apps for iPhone and Android, as well as the WhiskeyCast website. That's also where you'll find links for the WhiskeyCast Facebook page and my Twitter feed, the calendar of events, the WhiskeyCast store powered by Amazon.com, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is www.whiskeycast.com. And my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@whiskeycast.com. WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2011, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.